All right, welcome to episode 22, maybe, of Beer Opinions Podcast. As always, my name is Pat Berger, owner of Kaiser Tiger and Patty Long's, and with me is Bruce White. Bruce, how you doing?
Doing well. Just checked.
Actually, of the Chicagoland Beer Tour. Sorry, Chicago. I didn't finish your full title.
No worries. We're actually episode 23.
This is really starting off great.
I did check.
It's 23?
Yeah.
MJ's number. 23.
Yeah.
It's a good number.
Yeah, so ready to rock and roll.
I'm feeling better about this already. It's going to be so good.
Yeah.
I just want to remind our listeners that you can find us at beeropinions.com and on iTunes. Tell your friends, tell your relatives. Tell anyone you know, beeropinions.com. And we are here every 2 weeks to discuss the latest and greatest in beer in Chicago and around the world. And if you're lucky, sometimes we have a guest, and today we're lucky. With us today is the beer master from Pilsner Urquell, direct from the Czech Republic, Mr. Robert Lebowski. That's not right. Lebowski. How do you say it?
Just don't make me the Big Lebowski.
I know. It came right out.
I'm not that.
It's my favorite movie.
It's my favorite movie.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
All right. We're here with the dude.
Just Lebowski.
Just the dude. Robert, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks.
Our pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a good time last night. You guys previewed a movie about what's called Beer Masters.
Brewmasters.
I'm not getting anything right today. Brewmasters. It's releasing in January, I believe.
That's correct.
And you can actually see a trailer for it at beeropinions.com. Again, that's beeropinions.com.
I think you might be in there somewhere.
I even made the trailer. I'm like the buzzkill moment of the trailer. Everyone's like, ooh, beer's so great. Everything's awesome. This is going to go on forever. And then it gets to me, and I'm like, yeah, the bubble's bursting. We're all going to die.
Very characteristic for you, isn't it?
Yeah, someone's got to play the bad guy.
My only question is, how did they talk you into a nude scene in a beer movie?
You know, they were trying to talk me out of it.
But that was the only way.
I wasn't having any of it, you know. That was my chance. Finally, show off the Irish pride down there.
Hold on, boys. What's the censorship on this?
It's explicit. Trust me. Yeah. We can say anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very fine movie, and real heavyweights on it, and then me for some reason. But Robert, of course, is featured along with Vakal from Pilsner Urquell.
Yes, our brewmaster Václav Brink is featured as well. That's correct.
We've got Sam Caligioni is in there from Dogfish Head. Rob Todd from Allagash. The owner of The Alchemist, I don't know his name. Anyway,
I forget as well. Oliver Garrett's in there.
Mr. Hetty Topper himself is in it. Oliver, yes, from Brooklyn Brewery is in it. Jim Cook is in there from Sam Adams. It's a really who's who. And then for some reason, me.
And Drew. Mustn't forget the main character.
Absolutely.
Drew. And yes. Brian.
So look for that. Probably, I don't know, online, I would imagine. It might be going straight to video. Look for it at your Blockbuster. Anyway,
what's the general idea? Is it really just talking about kind of?
It follows one gentleman who is trying to start his own brewery.
Okay,
that's Mr. Drew.
And it follows another gentleman who is trying to become a master cicerone.
Okay,
that's Mr. Brian.
And then it has expert opinions on things by experts throughout it. It was very fine. I thought it was a good movie. When they came and interviewed me, I didn't realize it was like a real movie. I thought it was some fluff piece, but it's a real movie.
Well, I didn't think it was a fluff piece when they interviewed me, but I didn't realize it was a full movie either.
Well, I might have been drinking that day. I don't know. It was that was the night they came here for an unfiltered Pilsner event, Pilsner Urquell event, and were kind enough to interview me. Speaking of which, we're going to tap one at 6 o'clock tonight. The listeners, of course, God knows when this will be out. So
it'll be too late.
Yeah, it'll be too late for them. But we will also be tapping one at Patty Long's Saturday, November 11th. If this podcast gets out before then, it might, right? I think it will. Come the Patty Longs.
The magical date.
The magical date, November 11th. Uh-huh. I think I mentioned on the last podcast, too. So, anyway, Robert, let's start with, just start from the beginning. Where were you, you know?
Is this the sound of the music
is,
song?
Let's start is, at the really This is beginning. Your life, Robert. No. let's talk about Pilsner Kale. You're the beer master. What does that entail?
So the role of the beer master, basically, I split the role with the brewmaster. So obviously our brewmaster is dedicated to brewing the beer, something that our brewery was founded on two key values, and there was producing the consistency of a beer, because 175 years ago, consistency was a big issue, mm-hmm. not like today.
I think it is. Still.
Well,
you don't live in America, but go on.
Not with the bigger breweries, yes. I think
they've gotten much better, yes.
They may have got it fine patch by now.
Yes, yes.
So consistency on product and brewing from the most freshest ingredients. So obviously back then there was no such thing as properly storage of ingredients. So you brewed what basically the land gave you. And that's the whole story of Pilsner, more or less. And the fact that 175 years later this would be the most drank alcoholic beverage in the world is just phenomenal.
It is. And literally you guys were the first.
We were the godmothers of them all. That's mm-hmm. true.
Yes.
And that's exactly why we're here today with the unfiltered and unpasteurized version of it. Because this is the form, the shape, the still the cloudiness of the yeast in there that the citizens of my own hometown of Pilsen would have seen this liquid for the first time in the whole world 175 years ago on the 11th, which is when you're going to have it at Paddy Long's.
Yes.
That is the day, man. That's 175 years.
Excellent.
Wow. That was... What is that, 1842?
1842.
All right, yeah. And this is the story that I always tell on my beer tours, so this is like a good time to check and see if I'm correct here. Basically,
I'm not sure this is a good time to correct yourself.
Yeah,
it might be a little too late.
Well, I always tell my tours, I say, my motto is if it's on the internet, it has to be true. So, so it's okay to correct. But basically, the story that I know is kind of most of the world's Pilsner, pre-1842, pre-you guys brewing it, were of the ale variety. And in the town of, not all, but, and they didn't really quite understand the science. We're starting to understand it, but didn't understand the kind of two distinctions between the styles of ales and lagers. And so then they, and in the town of Pilsen, they had a city brewery that was brewing some inconsistent beer. They kind of built a new modern brewery and hired this young brewmaster, and I forget his name, but...
Joseph Grohl.
Yes, all right, thank you. And then he kind of, for the first time, used these lagering techniques on a mass scale, and Pilsner was the result. Light, effervescent, much different than kind of the top-fermenting ales that were more prevalent at the time. Is that kind of how it worked, or...?
I think if I were you, I'd consider a different job line.
He already is. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know. I'm here in my corporate finest. Oh,
jokes aside. More or less, you're hitting the nail on the head. Let me correct you on a couple of things, though.
All right.
Lagers already existed prior to that.
Sure.
Lagers were invented very widely brewed in Bavaria. What allowed them to do it was the cave systems around the mountains that they have around surrounding Munich and that part of the world. And obviously in the lagers, you had consistent temperature, and that allowed lagering. That's where that whole thing started from. And that obviously came out with the founding of different yeast strains, which would allow for fermentation and lagering process to take place in such a cold environment. So that already had existed. What didn't exist was the golden color. It was the pale malting. Pale malting was not performed on lagers, more or less, until then. So pale ales had been invented. It was the English who invented pale malting. But it was not used for lagers till then, until Pilsner was born. So the way it came around was, let me correct you on the second thing, actually.
No, this is good. This is good.
School's in.
Let me correct you on the second thing, which is very important, actually. So prior to Pilsner Miracle, it was no such a thing as one brewery in town. Pilsen was more or less given the rights to brew in the year 1295, like 150 years before even the discovery of the United States continent, yeah. And back then, the king gave us rights to 260 households, which was, the town did not have more than 290 households at that time. And still today, if you visit Pilsen, the old town of Pilsen is still the same structured city as it was back then. So 260 households had the right to brew beer. And that more or less pertained until the times of 1838 when that revolution came in. And that's when these 260 households basically said, it's enough. We need to make a change. Obviously, the ale brewing meant back in those days that the quality of it was very much a result of the temperature outside. So spring, autumn were perfect times for brewing. Winter, they were lacking ingredients, so the ingredients wasn't probably that fresh. And summertime was probably problematic. Yeah, the faster you ferment it, the shorter the shelf life, more or less, of your beer and the quality of it. So came the year 1838, and the guys in Pilsen, there were seven of them, more or less, the keen brewers, basically said it's enough. And for a town that had been brewing beer for over 500 years then, they made something which was unheard of, and that is they dumped 36 barrels of beer, bad beer, in front of the town hall. Now, let's think about it. I mean, you have multiple generations of families brewing beer. All they did was brew and drink it and sell a little bit of it, and suddenly they're dumping 36 barrels down the drain. So that was a big statement, and that led to actually the unification of all the brewers. They signed a petition, and that petition basically released them from having their rights and becoming shareholders of a new project. And that project was to become a city brewery. And it's still now very much tied to the city. And the town of Pilsen is nothing, well, it is less without the brewery, and the brewery is very little without the city. We're still very much part of the whole DNA. So that's how that whole thing started.
Okay. Oh, that's great. No, thank you. That I'm going to revise the script later tonight, I think.
Anytime. Just give me a call.
There we go. No, that's great. Thank you. But hugely influential, I think. I read at one point that 90% of the beers now drank in the world are of the lager style, and approximately, and again, correct me if I'm wrong on these numbers too, but I think approximately half of those were Pilsners, the specific style. Specifically, so it was a tremendous change in terms of the popularity of lagers and Pilsner specifically, because It started, you guys were ground zero of that, I think.
Sure. I mean, if you take it into consideration, last year there was around the world, the beer production was around, I think, 2.85 billion hectolitres, which is 370 billion pints of beer drank around the world. And if you take that into consideration, that 60% or almost 70%, I beg your pardon, two-thirds, almost 70% of the total volume are Pilsner-style lagers.
Okay.
175 years later, I dare say this is probably one of the liquids that has shaped not just the beer industry, but it's shaped the consumer's perception of what a liquid of a beer style in this case is. And we could argue what the other one is, but I think most people will guess that it's that sugary, very high carbonated, sort of blackish, darkish liquid, yeah, with the CCs in there. But Pilsner Urquell definitely had that impact, I believe, and it's great to see.
Certainly. You could say it also, I mean, it's the forebearer of what America had been drinking until recently, which is, you know, what we call American light lager. Mm-hmm. You know, Miller Lite even has the audacity to call themselves a true Pilsner beer. Don't worry, they don't own you guys anymore. You can say bad things about them, Robert.
I don't have anything bad to say about anyone. That's not my nature.
Just leave it to me then. Anyway, and obviously Budweiser went as far as to copy their name from a Czech brewery. You know, you could say they're the forebearers of what we ended up with here in America as far as our number one style of beer, American light lager.
Well, bear in mind that, I mean, Pilsner Urquell had an enormous influence on the beer drinking here prior to Prohibition. Pilsner Urquell was the biggest imported brand coming into the U.S. We were joint partners with Guinness back then. And, I mean, 33% of the total production. So in the year 1913, our brewery produced for the first time 1 million hectolitres of beer. And 320,000 hectolitres of that was for the U.S. continent. Huh. So we can sort of see how Pilsner had shaped, definitely, the beer industry in the U.S. What's really nice to see now that in places like Chicago and the crafty places, Pilsner's returning back in. It's like suddenly becoming, we want that sessionability. Mm-hmm. Where did it go? And Pilsner still has a relevance in that whole consumer sort of spectrum.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the beer scene in America has gotten to the point where we've literally put anything that can go into a beer at this point. We've made every good and bad idea ever. And people are starting to realize that you actually have to drink it.
Yeah.
And,
it's time to stop the brewmasters in the part of wood I come from Bohemia, you know, western part of Czech Republic. It's time you stop making these brewmasters cry.
I had a cucumber Kolsch that would have brought everyone to tears. It brought me to tears. It did not work.
One of the greatest pinnacles.
Grown men crying in the Czech Republic over that cucumber Kolsch. Grown men.
I mean, one of the greatest pinnacles in the history of beer is obviously the purity law from 1516. And let's just stick to the basics. I mean, already back then, they knew what was best for a beer. And the fact that you only brew from those three fundamental ingredients, which is barley, water, and hops, let's just remember that. There is a little bit of wisdom in what our predecessors had.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to throw the whole American craft brewing scene under the bus. But, you know, I got jumped on a podcast where it was during the 500th anniversary of the Rheinheitsgebot or something, you know, some anniversary. And so we were talking about it on Chris Quinn's podcast, and all of the brewers there were like, oh, didn't this really just set Germany back? You know, it really handcuffed all these breweries in Germany. And I was the only one who was like, well, you know, no. You know, there was a reason for this. It has produced, you know, some of the best beers in the world, in my opinion. And when you put constraints on people, you end up tweaking things to a point where it's almost perfect. You know, when the whole world is your oyster, you tend, you know, there's breweries that pride themselves on never making the same beer twice. Well, you know, I'm sorry, but making it over and over and over and over again, you end up with something that's, you know, perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as in the Brewmaster movie, though, there was a clear statement there that if you can reproduce the same brew the same way, maybe you should not call yourself a brewmaster.
Yeah, yeah. Garrett Oliver, I believe, said that, right? Yeah. And
especially in today's time where you control most of the quality of all the ingredients you put in there. There's no unknowns. So it's more or less just about your skill and your way of brewing the beer.
Well, the cucumber melon thing might be an unknown. I don't think we needed to know about that.
Nobody. I was a mistake. it was a mistake. Now, have you noticed, you know, obviously the craft trend here in the States is just exploded. Have you kind of hinted at this, I think, that have you noticed also a resurgence in demand for Pilsner Urquell and here in those cities as well? Or is people kind of pursue kind of a counter trend almost, but pursue perfection, pursue the best at kind of the traditional lagers, that sort of thing?
So maybe I want to answer that question. I'll ask Pat. Well, let's take Pat's story. Yeah, where was he 5 years ago with Pilsner Urquell in his mind? Where is he with Pilsner Urquell in his mind today? I mean, there's been a lot of revolution. I think Pat's a great example for me. Yes, we did go through a bit of a rough patch in the United States, and that was purely done by the aging of the product or the mistreatment of the product, I would say. We've done a lot of things to help the handling of it. Part of my role is exactly that. How do we educate? Not just the right storage, the right logistics, but it's actually how you pour the beer, what you pour it into, and how you take care of simple things like your equipment that you're using. And once you get the ABCs right, you actually find that this beer is actually very, very highly sessionable. And it's the reason why in the Czech Republic we have a simple rule on our drinking habits. We always only drink two beers a day. Yeah, we drink the first and the last. There's no point counting what's in between because the sessionability of this liquid is so high when you have it right.
Yeah. You know, I agree. I heard an interesting note from Evan Rail, who we all know, he's a beer writer, American guy in Prague. And he talked about how here in the U.S., everyone argues about which beer is better. You know, what's the best beer? You know, have you had this beer? You know, I rated this beer this and blah, blah, blah. And that's not really the beer conversation in the Czech Republic. And I think Ireland's another good example. People don't argue about whether or not Pilsner or Kell is a good beer or Radagast or, you know, whatever it is. They argue about who serves the best pint of it, right? And same in Ireland, you know, no one argues about whether or not Guinness is good. They argue about who serves the best one. And it puts the emphasis on the publican, which I think is the next step here in America, because we're not doing that just yet. I think we're starting to get there. But for so many years, bar owners and bar employees have been serving beer that is somewhat indestructible. You know, a case of Miller Lite can go through a lot of things and not necessarily get damaged. It's highly pasteurized and
you serve it cold.
Yeah,
cold.
And their quality control is great. It's not a delicate product, is what I'm saying. It's a very hard product to make, and I'm not, you know, bashing it on any of that. But it was certainly never in a publican's mind that, oh, I've got to rotate, you know, my Miller Lite stock, and I've got to make sure I keep these kegs cold, and I've got to make sure I keep the bottles cold, and all this kind of stuff, and make sure my lines are impeccable. And that, I think, is the next step here in the U.S. And it's my understanding, I haven't been to the Czech Republic yet, but a lot of these bars really take this to heart, and not only how they're curating the beer, but how they're pouring it. And that's another thing that's not talked about at all in the U.S. You know, you just pour a beer, it comes out of a tap, put it in a glass, and then you put it in front of someone. That's, you know, there's bartenders, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, who are famous for the way they pour beer, and people will only have their beer poured by that individual, that kind of a thing.
We don't call them bartenders.
Yeah, what do you call them?
Now we call them tapsters.
Tapsters.
These are guys, honestly, I believe Czech Republic is the only nation in the world that has that as a profession, where we have people in every outlet who's dedicated to just looking after the beer. So who's responsible for accepting the beer on delivery, responsible for the cleanness of the lines, the cleanness of the equipment, and most importantly, he's responsible for cleanness of the glass. And when you get that chemistry together, then it just becomes a simple skill how to pour it properly and get the taste out properly. So, but you're absolutely right. It's these guys make or break a pub in the Czech Republic. They're actually, besides the chef in the kitchen, these two guys are the most important people. But it also comes from the culture that in the Czech Republic we're still very much brand loyal. I would not say we're not competitive. I don't think I will little question what you said about not, you know, a little bit of that jitter talk about mine's better than yours in terms of the beer they're drinking. Yeah. I think that still happens. In the Czech Republic, every beer drinker is actually an expert, or he believes is an expert on beer. The greatest thing about... And now I have to be biased. The greatest thing about Pilsner Urquell is actually unites all these drinkers. So as much as you might not want to drink some beers that these guys are drinking, they will be always happy to sit at a table and have a Pilsner with you. Because Pilsner historically does stand for the highest quality, and that perception of drinkability is there. This is the liquid of gods, yeah. As you I think you said it, Pat.
Well, someone texted that to me. What time are you tapping the liquid of the gods?
Yeah.
It was a brewmaster that texted me that. So, you know, I think that's also what's kind of separating beer bars from, you know, regular bars here in the U.S. now. Everyone thinks they're a beer bar, and they're pretty sure that their beer menu is what makes them a beer bar, right? Just buying this stuff and putting it on tap and... Hey, look, I've got all of this American craft beer on.
And the newest stuff trends.
Yeah, newest trends, stuff that's hard to find. That doesn't make you a beer bar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I've said it before. I would rather go to a bar that had, you know, beers that you can buy at 7-Eleven that were impeccably stored on clean lines and poured properly than half of these so-called beer bars nowadays. You know, it's... what is the point of having all of this really expensive rare beer if you don't know what you're doing once mm-hmm. you get it in your hands, you know. And you know,
that's very much what part of my job is as well.
Yeah,
that education bit,
right?
Because especially with Pilsner Urquell, I mean, Pilsner Urquell is a perfect equilibrium of two extreme worlds. One is the sweetness of the malty sweetness that we have remaining in our beer, because our yeast don't convert all the sugars. And the other is the extreme amount of hops that we use to brew our beer, which is in this case Saaz hops. So you've got bitter and sweet. And when it's served properly in the right way, in the clean glass, when all the ABCs are right, it becomes very sessionable. But it is so easy to tip the scale. Yeah, we always say that the bartender, so firstly, in the brewery we have a saying, historical saying, and that's the brewmaster brews the beer and the bartender makes the beer. And it's absolutely true, because at any time a bartender's pouring a beer, he's got two options. He can actually make a standard lager out of Pilsner Urquell that will taste a little bit more bitter, a little bit more carbonated, or he can actually make that perfect experience that the gods would like to have.
Let's talk about that, because, you know, I'll be honest, first time I met you, Robert, you know, a couple years ago, you were going on about these different pours that are done with Pilsner Urquell, and I was kind of rolling my eyes a little bit, you know, and while, you know, I already believed that you can make a beer look beautiful, and we drink with our eyes just like we eat with our eyes, and it makes a big difference, I did not really buy into your idea that the beer, you can actually make the beer taste different through how you pour the beer. And I am a believer now. You've converted me.
I know you are.
So let's talk about that really quick. You know, I can tell you we're here at Kaiser Tiger, we do the crisp pour. At Patty Long's, we do the crisp and the smooth. Mm-hmm. Depending on customer preference. And that is, we're going to change that today here at Kaiser, because you're, after this podcast, Robert is going to have a little training session with my bartenders. But why don't we start with those two and the difference and how they affect the flavor?
Sure. I mean, so what the reason why we actually started doing these different pours worldwide is not because we want to be that interesting, but it's a perfect tool how to educate in quite simple way the mistreatment you can have on your beer. So crispy pour is all about high carbonation. It's all about a lot of bitterness coming out. It's the 39 IBUs we have in our beer that come out in your taste profile. And believe it or not, the crispy pour is a standard way how 99% of all bartenders in the world will pour your beer. Mm. Yeah, it's actually really interesting when you think about it, how much that has influenced the perception of what a Pils Lager is worldwide. To the extent where in England, a Pils Lager means bitter. Yeah, they're expecting bitterness. On the other hand, when you pour your beer the smooth way, for example, we're balancing the two worlds of the sweet and the bitter. So although the liquid's still the same, it still has 39 IBUs, very rarely do you get to taste that. And that just brings up the whole sessionability.
So
How does that work? Well, it actually works. Well, the hidden secret's in the CO2. No, it's actually the CO2 content. So human brain actually requires CO2 to generate the taste experience of bitterness. Now, the less CO2 you have in there, the less bitterness you're going to be experiencing. So our Mlieko pour, which is just the foam, the smooth, wet foam, that brings out all the sweetness of our malt. And it doesn't mean it's not... It doesn't have the hops in there. It still has the 39 IBUs, but it doesn't bring it out. Your brain doesn't register it as strongly.
Which is also popular at Patty Long's. People know about that now. They come in, they want a milk.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, you should try it.
I have. I've been known to slam one or two.
Okay. So the different pours are basically, it was an educational tool, how we can show anyone in the world the fact that beer is not just a beer. What has become over the last 50 years is that beer has become a commodity. And it's actually the result why the bar trade people actually treat it as such. For them, as you said, I'm not going to rename the brands, but, you know, they were used to just, it's a golden liquid.
Yes, it's inventory.
You put the keg on and it's going to be perfect. Well, not perhaps perfect, but it's going to sell the way I'm going to pour it.
Yep.
And for us, these three pours actually educate people that, well, there's more to there's more to beer than just the simplicity how it's being perceived at this stage. And with Pilsner Urquell, brewing our beer using the same ingredients to the same recipe, which means we can't actually simplify or we can't sort of stabilize the beer any further. It's a food product more or less than a beer. So you've got these two components in there, which is what beer is all about: sweetness and bitterness in a harmony. And by these three pours, we can actually illustrate. You can either bring the sweetness out, the bitterness, or you can have a perfect pint. You choose what you want to pour. But I tell you, there's 11 million people in the Czech Republic who know which pour is the right one.
Is there obviously you should, in defense of Pat here, enjoy this the most possible at a bar here locally, watering hole primarily. But if people wanted to experiment at home doing this, could they also manipulate, like if they went and bought a case of the Pilsner, and can they try to do that, or are there any tips to that, or is it mainly a trained bartender that you need?
That one's a bit more difficult to achieve.
Yeah, okay.
And the home experience. Sure. That's not to say you can't attempt to do it. Obviously, the CO2 content within the liquid is based on two facts. One is the pressure that you're pushing the beer out with, and secondly, the temperature that the beer is in. Yeah, CO2 is always going to be in the liquid. Depending on those two factors, will influence how much CO2 you're going to release. So you could still play around with it at home. I believe that if you were to refrigerate a can low enough, then give it a bit of a shake before you do, so you get the foaming effect coming out, perhaps you could pour a sort of a mean Ladinka. But by definition, you can't. Yeah, I mean, you can get a similar effect, but by definition, you can't, because the Hladinka style is all about entrapping the beer beneath that white foam, making sure that the beer stays unoxidized as long as you're drinking it. And for us, that is actually the primary reason why in Europe as a whole, actually, besides UK, there's the Brexit going on, so they won't be part of the Europe anymore. just jokes aside there. In majority of Europe, it's a standard thing that your pint of beer is going to have 3-4 centimeters of foam on top, because you want that freshness of the beer to be there. Why drink something that's oxidized? I mean, are you going to eat a chicken which has been exposed to the sun? You're not. You want the freshest ingredients to eat. Same applies to drinking.
Yeah. Well, I assume it definitely would taste different out of a bottle or can versus pouring it in a glass, just based on that carbon, getting the carbon dioxide or the CO2 out of the beer.
Sure.
I obviously can't express myself. Not well. Yeah.
But at the same time, bear in mind, the draft beer is always going to be the freshest beer.
Yeah.
And you're also, if you're drinking it straight out of a bottle, you also are going to miss out on the aromatics. You're not smelling anything. Your nose is not involved in drinking out of a bottle.
Yeah. Great. No, this is great. I figured people listening at home who, might want to go experiment could go to their watering hole, but also maybe pick up a case or whatever. So
cool.
No, but I mean, just bear in mind, every brewmaster is going to say to you that the best way to actually experience the beer is to go to the brewery.
Yeah.
And the closest you're going to get to that is always going to be in the pub, draft beer. That's where the emotional attachment to the right taste of the product is always, that's where it evolves.
Great.
That's why on-trade exists, more or less, in the end.
No, that's the truth. And at the brewery, you have the person that cares the most about how that beer is being poured and presented, and that's the brewer. He's there, and, the breweries I've worked at, he's usually a very ornery person who, if he catches a bartender mistreating his beer, they'll hear about it real quick. And that's, that's what I've always tried to, replicate that in my bars. We call it the poor police, I've taken people aside all the time, Robert mentioned the whole foam thing. That's a battle I've been fighting for a long time here in the U.S. And I've had people trying to send their beer back to me because there's too much foam. No, I want beer, And
oh, they think that you're kind of trying to
that's why,
cheat them out of some beer.
Years ago, we went to marked glasses, so that I can say, look,
it's filled up.
It's marked right here, half liter. And the rest of that is meant to be foam. And if you don't like it, if you don't like the foam, that's fine. But I'm not putting any more beer past that line, And that's, it's gotten easier. But 10 years ago, that was a hard conversation with people.
Huh. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. This is not just the US. This is worldwide.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, England. They'll... they don't
and
like...
It's, and it's not just England. It's all the beer nations that the English actually helped to educate on beer. So even the whole Scandinavia, which came online with alcohol only in the late 1990s. There was prohibition till then, more or less. And today there's still a bit of a prohibition
really?
By the government. Yeah, alcohol is controlled by the government.
No wonder I've never been there.
but they have been educated by the English. The English beer drinkers sort of started that whole education. And till today, foam is a bit of an issue up north as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, have you, so the craft beer scene obviously blown up here. Have you noticed in the Czech Republic a craft scene kind of coming up as well?
Is there any interest in American craft beer in the Czech Republic?
Because
it's creeping into Germany, which they're
it's all over Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Denmark to Germany to even Italy.
That's huge in Denmark, right?
But Denmark has been historically. I remember 16 years ago, Denmark had the biggest boom in microbreweries growth. Even before sort of the US started going absolutely mental, Denmark was going mental. There were like 150 breweries popping up every month, and that lasted for like a year, and then there was like 400 popping down every month.
Yeah.
But I remember then, you know, you had beer stores where you had thousands of different beer labels, and you think on a small country like Denmark with that small population, how it could survive long enough. But back then, we had, you know, there were great. There's the great Copenhagen craft beer festival, where these craft brewers actually,
or McKellar and
and they every year they have a competition to brew actually a pilsner. That's the main beer they're trying to achieve, and every year they sort of benchmark it against Pilsner Urquell. So Denmark for me was actually the craft nation in Europe that started that whole movement. But very much so, Czech Republic has gone down that path as well. So today,
so are there small breweries popping up? What kind of beer are they making?
I was going to say, so today, so let's take it back 5 years ago. 5 years ago in the Czech Republic, there would have been not more than 150 breweries. 5 years later, we're hitting 350. Like, this is the same amount of breweries that was there before the First World War. And the kinds of beer, well, bear in mind, we are a lager. We are a Pils lager nation. So 16 million hectolitres of one standard style of beer that's drank in the Czech. But there is a lot of experimentation, definitely. The IPAs are coming through, the stouts they're playing around with.
Mm-hmm.
The uptake from the consumers, it's going to take a few more generations, I think, before we start going on a mass sort of drinkability of these. Today, out of the 16 million hectolitres, the whole craft scene's only about less than 2%.
Yeah.
Which for a Czech consumer that drinks at least 140 litres of beer a year, it doesn't represent that much of an influence, if you like.
You guys are number one, right, in beer drinking per person?
We're doing our best. as I say, 142 litres per person, that includes everybody. Yeah.
Man, woman, and child.
And the dogs and cats. So you've got to take those into consideration as well. So if you do, you know, if you go to your demographics and you come down to the core of drinkers, you probably end up with a 2 to 3 million people that are drinking around 400 litres a year, which is about two beers a day, which is not that much.
Certainly not.
No. It's almost a...
I call that breakfast.
Thank you. I was trying to figure out what's the correct thing to say, but I think it's almost it's the healthy part of the diet then.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, yes. Everything in moderation, including moderation.
Definitely.
Yeah, sometimes.
No, that's actually very much an old rule that we seem to forget nowadays. You know, there's all these faps coming up, and I'm not just talking about beer. It's about everything, any food, any lifestyle sort of a thing. This is the best thing to do right now, but hey, just bear in mind, everything in moderation is probably good for you.
Yeah, it's probably the best, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That being said, I'm going to have like 15 of those unfiltered pilsners tonight.
Excellent.
Yeah. Now,
only?
That's moderation for me on that. Unfiltered pilsner.
And the unfiltered pilsner, just for the listeners out there, that's basically the yeast is still in the beer, correct?
That's correct. So the beer's gone through its natural first filtration process. It hasn't gone through its final filtration. So there's still a bit of yeast left in the beer. what is special about these batches is that it has, honestly, the yeast is still part of the original strain of the yeast, which we cultivate every month, just enough for our requirements on the volume production. And you guys get to taste what that is. And for me, that's unique because the yeast, although it is unique to us, it just hasn't changed for 175 years. You can't change it because that's what makes Pilsner Urquell different. That's why none of the other breweries have ever replicated a Pilsner Urquell entirely. Maybe they wanted to. Maybe they could have, actually. Bear that in mind. But which brewery would actually brew a beer where the ingredients, the cost of the ingredients you put into your beer, you don't actually transform into total alcohol, which is where is the final price comes from. Yeah, the more alcohol you have, the higher the money you're going to pay because the higher the excise tax you're going to pay.
Yeah.
So maybe that was actually part of a barrier why nobody wanted to produce a similar, or not similar, the exact sort of a product. But bear in mind, that is actually the magic of Pilsner Urquell. Yeah, because you have that natural sugar extract left in the beer. That sweet maltiness is in there. Whilst most other lagers or pils lagers will convert, they will not have that. It's all converted into your
they're very
alcohol
dry.
And CO2,
yeah.
And they dry.
Yeah. And, you know, dry has become a buzzword in American craft brewing. And, you know, everything has to be dry now. And it doesn't have to be dry. You know, I keep telling these people, like, look, yeah, certain styles are really nice when they're dry. I like a dry Saison, you know. I like, you know, a few different kinds of dry, you know, dry beers. But, you know, at the end of the day, we have to drink this, like I said before. And when you're drinking something dry all night long, your tongue can get stuck to the roof of your mouth, you know. It's not pleasant. It's not thirst-quenching. It doesn't beg for another pint. You know, you have to have that balance. And, you know, I hope some brewers are listening. I hope they're also listening. You know, Pilsner Urquell makes one beer, right?
We do.
One beer.
Huh.
And they have been making this one beer for a very long time. You guys aren't coming out with a Northeast IPA anytime soon, are you?
Why do I always get these questions?
Got to get that haze. Yeah. Well, that's the
It's
unfiltered.
A banned subject. Banned subject. I didn't say it. We're not talking
about it. The answer is no.
But, you know. But a lot of these craft breweries right now, and a lot of them are struggling right now because we're a little oversaturated in the U.S., and they're just throwing mud at the wall and seeing what sticks. And, you know, I want to tell them, like, look, this one beer you made was fantastic. Push that. Just find that, you know, tweak that until it's even more perfect, and then push that into the market and be the best of that style that you can be, you know. And stop coming out with a new beer every week because, you know, I'm not going to buy it if I haven't tasted it. And chances are, if it's the first batch of it, I don't want to taste it. Mm-hmm. You know? Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. No, I won't. That's what the show is.
That's the beer.
It's my soapbox.
But I did. I think it's worth mentioning, though, that the craft movement has influenced very much Czech Republic as well. Including our brewery. So obviously our brewery is a company of four breweries nowadays, or historically even. And it's even, I mean, we have 49.9% market share in the Czech Republic as the company. And that gives us a little bit of, obviously, influential power on consumers' behaviors. And it's caused even our brewery to actually introduce something called a rotational tap in our pubs, which never existed in the Czech Republic. As I mentioned earlier, we're very brand loyal, so are the pubs. And the rotational taps are all about, we're actually introducing different styles of beer as a brewer. We're introducing different styles of beer to the consumers. It's a limited batch. It's 1,000 hectares a month. But every month we produce something different.
How many pubs do you guys own?
Well, there's 35,000 total outlets in the Czech Republic. We have a little bit of those.
Okay.
No. I think we're in more than we want to be with Pilsner Urquell. But we are sitting around 16,000, 18,000. So.
But you have ownership in the pubs themselves?
No.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
No.
Is that illegal in the Czech Republic? Yeah.
It's not illegal, but it would be very expensive.
Right. So you guys don't own any pubs anywhere in the world?
No.
No?
No.
Interesting.
The only pub we could claim to own is the Pilsen pub
The one in the brewery, yeah. Or
we owned that one, but I was more referring to the one in the museum. So the Beer Museum, which we own.
Okay.
There's a little pub there, which is exclusive to our brewery. And that's the only place in the whole world where you can actually drink the unfiltered Pilsner all year round.
Hmm.
It's the mecca of beers, and this is the one place that... This is one beer hall that never dries up.
I need to head to the Czech Republic. I'm going to put that on the list.
I'm going in March.
Can't wait. Nice.
Oh, my God.
Well, looking forward to that, Pat.
Oh, Robert's going to have to throw me out of this place.
You're going to adjust that per capita 400...
My intake goes toward the American average. Yeah. And yes, I've been doing my part for a long time. I've us in the top 20, I think. But
yeah, I think you guys are just over 100 liters per capita, isn't it, at the moment?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think I saw some statistics like that.
Yeah, but, you know, we're getting there.
But you're a big country.
Yeah, we are a big country and a lot of Puritan pukes in this country.
We need to get more kids to drink. I just, you know, I'm kidding.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that.
I'm kidding, obviously.
We would never suggest children.
But grandparents, let's
drink beer.
But, you know.
No, we're just kidding. As a father of three, I will not let my children drink until they're at least 16. I mean, 21. What's the law? 21, right? Yes. I myself never had a beer till I was 12. 21. Sorry, reverse it. 21. All right. How are we doing on time? All right. Not too bad. What else do we need to pester Robert about? I don't know. I need another beer. Tell you that.
Now let me just say a couple of words, which might be interesting for the listeners.
Yes, please.
Yeah. There's a great moment in Pilsen's history, which is very much tied to the national proudness of this wonderful country, and that's actually the 4th of May every year, when we celebrate the liberation of Pilsen by the army of George Patton. It was 3 days before the end of the Second World War, and you actually liberated us. We were meant to be part of the Western world if there wasn't that agreement repeating in history that we should be given to the Russian Federation then. But George Patton sat around in outside of Pilsen for 3 days. He was ordered to sit around in a town called Rokitsani for about 2.5 days, waiting for the Russian armies to actually come down from Warsaw, which was almost a three-day drive for the tanks. And he was not allowed to enter the capital city because then the Americans would have liberated the whole country. So we actually celebrate the liberation every year, and we get the veterans come through. And unfortunately, they're aging. So last year, the greatest generation is not many left. Yeah, well, there's only one left. This year, only one of the last surviving veterans showed up.
Wow.
Obviously, the family members are still coming, so the parade is enormous. But that is a very proud moment in history where. The American flags are out there. We obviously have monuments for the American liberation, and even George Patton now has a monument in Pilsen. So there's a bit of an insight into American history right in my own hometown.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing.
So you're saying we can go as Americans on May 4th, and it'll be...
You'll be the heroes.
Oh, we'll be the heroes. That's kind of rare in Europe right now as an American, I'll be honest.
Yeah,
I've had to answer some very hard questions the last few trips to Europe. We won't say who those questions are about.
Sure.
Because this is a beer program, not a political program, right? Right, Chris?
Right.
Bruce, right?
Right. Yes. No politics.
That's right. That's right.
No New England IPAs, no politics. Those are the rules.
That's right. Those are the rules. Well, that's very interesting, you know. All right, well, what do we have going on? Chris, Bruce? I keep calling you Chris because that's your name, actually, but I mean Bruce.
Bruce is my name, too. It's just
I know.
I'm corporate Chris and beer Bruce, you know?
Yes.
So
I got it. All right, it's Bruce now.
I must be Mickey Mouse then. I'm sorry. I'm confused.
Bruce is my middle name, but it's my beer drinking name.
It's an ongoing joke. I can't get it right.
Well, just call me the dude then.
I know.
Yes. Oh man, yeah, not too much going on. Still rocking and rolling with the beer tours, so kind of going to a more reduced schedule starting soon with the winter time. But we're actually opening up our loop tour pretty much year round, just due to the popularity. We're going to kind of adjust the route so there's less walking because of the cold. But otherwise, it's a great way for people to kind of get outside, particularly tourists visiting the city and still want to kind of explore Chicago's beer scene and bar scene and learn some cool Chicago history.
How do you reserve a spot on the beer tour?
You can check us out at www.chicagobeerexperience.com. You can book online. There's also a phone number you can call to reserve your tickets.
Fantastic.
Chris Brews, that sounded like you've said that a couple of times before.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Robert, what's happening with you? Where are you off to after Chicago?
I'm going to be doing a short trip down to San Francisco, get the local folks down south also excited with the 175th celebration. One of the three key markets in the U.S. So I've done New York earlier on this week, Chicago now, and San Fran is my final part of the hill climb.
Is that when you guys are premiering your cucumber pilsner? Is that happening?
God bless you.
He shot me a bad look.
Yeah. And a couple moments of silence there.
Excellent. All right, what's happening here? Well, we know about Patty Long's on November 11th. I will mention November 11th as well here at Kaiser Tiger. We have our annual Dice of Doom.
Yeah, I was invited to that. I think Sam invited on Facebook.
Yes, it's the most ridiculous beer event known to man where we have, let me see if I can get it straight. We have barrel-aged Malort. We have Malort barrel-aged Three Floyds Dark Lord beer. And we have Dark Lord barrel-aged Malort. Does that make sense?
I don't know if it does, and I don't know if I want it to.
So we have Malort aged in barrels, we have Dark Lord aged in a Malort barrel, and we have Malort that was aged in a Dark Lord barrel.
I'm so glad you didn't get me to say that.
And just to make it even stupider, you have to roll a 20-sided die, Dungeons & Dragons style, and see if you win a taste of the evil barrel-aged Dark Lord. Or you could win a shot of Malort, although I don't think that's a win.
I was going to say, is that a win?
You might win a piece of bacon.
Oh, that's a win.
That's a win, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Or some pathetic swag that we'll have around, some stickers and... That's kind of the booby prize.
Half win.
But everyone wins. Every roll is a win.
Being a Czech, I'll stick to the bacon.
Have you had Malort, Robert?
No.
Oh, you should have just said yes, because by the end of this night, you shall.
Tonight, we dine in hell.
Look at that. We have a Malort virgin over there. She'll be popping his Malort cherry this evening.
Folks, it sounds like this is the last time you're going to hear my voice.
The last you'll ever hear of Robert. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Again, tell your friends, www.beeropinions.com, and you can also find us on iTunes.
Yeah. Shout out to my buddy Steve for listening and all the other fans out there.
Shout out to all the fans. Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you very much. Cheers.